Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
And gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Griese! Ladies and gentlemen, time to get in the game.
And good morning once again. This is Coach Chuck Griese. Every Wednesday at noon on the We Coach Tennis Network. Folks, the UR Tennis Network, thank you, Jason Haynes, for being the doggone for 4 years now. We just finished our fourth year. We're in our fifth, actually. WeCoachTennis.com, you can get the show if you'll go there. Also to the We Coach Tennis Network, thank you, J.P. Weber, who is now the director and who runs the UR Tennis Network. Thank you, J.P. Thank you to also to the Parenting Aces program every Tuesday morning at noon. I think that Lisa Stone's on at noon on Tuesday. My program, American Tennis, every Wednesday at noon, and then 5:30 every Thursday afternoon, the John Denise with the Florida Connection. So, folks, we've got a lot of podcasts out there now and a lot of things going on. We're always trying to look for unique ways to bring information to you. The tennis news, it's really fun because you can get tennis news anytime you want. I do not know what we need to do to sort of break into the main market of television. I just am thankful that we do have the Tennis Channel and things. But other than the U.S. Open coming up, we have had a few programs on. But the best way to keep up with tennis, I think, is some of the podcasts. I notice there's a radio tennis podcast now out there and many, many more. But anyhow, we're the American Tennis program, and this is the start of my fifth year already. Wow, and thank you again to those folks who have made this possible. Last week's program, we had Robert Davis, professional, 26-year veteran of professional coaching. He's a tennis writer, and go back and listen to that podcast. It was a darn good one, and I've gotten a lot of feedback. If you would like to add your comments, go to my website is chuckcreasy.net, www.chuckcreasy.net. but also chuck@coachcreasy.com, chuck@coachcreasy.com. If you have any comments or if you have any ideas about our programs in the future. So that's pretty much it for the introduction. Just thanks for listening. It's really, really a pleasure. I appreciate it very, very much. But today's program is one of the instructional series, and I will be right back. Let me do these commercials, and I'll be right back, and we're going to go right on to the instructional series today. And I think that you're going to find it interesting, and it's a good way to save time and get your players further on down the line. If you can listen and hang on there, we'll be right back.
This is Coach J.P. Weber of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. In my 30 years experience in coaching tennis, I've never seen a better tennis training situation for children than Coach Creasy's Total Tennis Training Camps. Chuck Creasy has coached them and trained them in every arena from juniors to collegiate to professional tennis, and over 15,000 children have improved their games at his summer tennis camps. Find out more at chuckcreasy.net. That's chuckcreasy.net.
Coach Chuck Creasy, yeah, make him in America, and isn't the best line ever, dirty hands and a clean soul. how could that be better? How could it ever be better? What a great sport we're able to work in and coach in, and I hope you've been watching in the Little League World Series as well. Boy, oh boy, talking about the pureness of sport and how before it's been diluted, polluted, prostituted, as many of our sports go. We always say in American tennis, our job, stand up, speak out, say those things that need to be said. Edmund Burke always said that all that it takes for evil to prosper is for good people to do nothing. We often talk about the political things of tennis and the issues that we're having. Almost always, it has to do with top-down management instead of bottom-up growth. That's if you think about the problems we're having in government right now, the problems we're having with most of the bureaucracies. I don't care if it's a university bureaucracy or a ITA bureaucracy, the USTA, or any organization. Most of the time when an organization gets too powerful, they start dictating top-down as if they are the all-knowing, the all-powerful, the all-seeing, and we're just sort of some of the silly, stupid subjects that sort of operate in this sport. What we have to do, we have to empower our land base, our volunteers, all of the players. We have to have people falling in love again with tennis to the level that they play it for mastery more than they do success, and because it inspires their hearts and it inspires their souls. That's pretty much what we have to do, and the long and the short of it, we're not going to do it ever with top-down management. It just will not work. It depletes the energy out of the people, the top-down part of it. The people who are trying to implement everything, it grinds them down. At the same time, people are not inspired. We've got to inspire our base. We've got to inspire people to fall in love with tennis again. I've often, and this leads me into what we're going to talk about today, and that is how to streamline our coaching and our working with young people. And let me start off by saying, you know, I've often wondered why players can play this game for years and years and years, and at a certain point, after 2 or 3 years, the development of their game and their understanding of game, not maybe the physical part definitely, but their mental and emotional understanding and coming to a peaceful grip with where their game is at and seeing it at a much deeper light. And I've always said that it's more of an art form. It should be more of an art form than just a sport. And I don't even like it being called a game. I had a coach one time come up to me and say that, you know, it's just a game. Why are you getting so excited about it? Why are you so passionate about your positions? And I said, no, it's much more than a game. It's even much more than a sport. It's an art form. It's a passionate endeavor. I see it the way a musician sees their music. I see it the way that a painter sees their paintings. It's much more. The beauty that happens and the beauty that happens and is so obvious when a player finally finds their game style and is able to play with the mastery, for the mastery of it and for the honor and to honor it, it's just beautiful. And we have gotten wrapped up in success more than we have trying to work for the mastery. But I've always wondered, I've asked players, now you've already, at age 18, I'll ask a college player, you've already spent more time playing tennis than the hours that a brain surgeon spends in medical school trying to learn how to operate on a brain. And they get it perfect, and with experience, they get it more perfect. And why do we not progress after a certain level? You often see players stop their progression at 13, 14, and 15 years old. And for college players, let's face it, a lot of coaches feel they're done by the time they're sophomores. And why don't people continue to progress? Well, part of it is the passion that you have to have for the sport to go forward and the love that you have to have for the sport. But the base fundamentals, the nuts and bolts of it, or the meat and potatoes of it, is that, have you ever thought about how we continue to do the same kind of practices, work on the same things, and keep it pretty much the same routine that we did when the kids were 13, 14, and 15. In other words, I've often seen coaches in college still working on just forehands and backhands. Oh, we got his forehand finally worked out. And, 15 years of tennis, and we finally got it worked out here, and that's going to make all the difference. And, we finally got this backhand down. Oh, we were just working on volleys only. And don't get me wrong. All of these are very, very important to work on. All of those skill sets are very, very important to work on. But if we just continue to work on just the forehands and the backhand to serve and things, this is very much like the mechanics maybe of your penmanship or your writing. Can anybody write anymore out there? I don't know if anybody knows cursive anymore, but your penmanship, instead of, say we just keep talking about the way you make your A's and your B's and your writing, instead of the essay you're writing and the passion that this essay should invoke or evoke, is it invoke or evoke? Help me out there, folks. But which one is going to bear more fruit? And think about how we just don't move on down the road with our coaching. So it's really, really interesting. I've always wondered as a coach why people don't progress past a certain level. Now, I have a great challenge as a coach right now. I have a situation with the team, and our individuals usually start a little bit further down the road than some of the players have been recruited at some schools we compete with. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but the long story short, let's say I'm just using an example, I get a lot of three-star players and my opponents get a lot of five-star players. Now I've got to narrow the gap somehow. And I've got to figure a way to streamline my coaching. And I've got to find a way to not just narrow the gap and streamline it, but for my players to eventually be able to beat those five-star guys and the blue chip guys one day. And we've got to make this journey. Now, is it about physical ability? I mean, athleticism? Sometimes it is. But most of the time, and is it about forehands and backhands? You know, sometimes it is. But for the most part, the gap that we have to narrow and the journey that we need to make has to do with not the forehands and the backhands, and are the footwork, are these things that we work on anyway as a coach, but it is a pecking order, posturing, or a pecking order comfort that was established a long, long time ago. In other words, tennis is a pecking order sport, and once you get used to losing to somebody, you lose to them for a long time. And to overcome that pecking order, it is a tough, tough deal. Now, we're going to talk later in the program about how you overcome the pecking order and having breakdowns lead to breakthroughs, et cetera. But I want to go more to the brass tacks of how to overcome these gaps physically, mentally, and emotionally. Usually it's an emotional gap, emotional disadvantage that we have when our players have a lesser pecking order. It is a non-comfort of beating a player that is higher. It is a discomfort or a non-comfort at taking on all of the responsibilities of playing at a higher level. And it is a non-comfort of leaving your peer group and going on to a higher level. Very often we don't even see this, but to move on to a higher pecking order and a higher level, you have to leave the old pecking order and your group of friends and your best buddies and move to a higher level. But there's all these emotional implications. Then there are the mental implications of understanding the needs for your game at a higher level. But I want to talk, I want to cut through it here and sort of give you my story. So what am I doing? I've got to narrow the gap with my team and teams in our conference and also teams that are out there that we want to eventually overtake. Now, I've got in my head my goals of where I'm hoping, and no, not just hoping, I don't want to say hoping, working towards having our team achieve. Now, in order to make this happen, I'm either throwing a bunch of baloney out there and living a pipe dream, or we're going to actively make it happen. So what I've done is I've come up with a system, and I don't like systems, first of all. Let's see. A method of coaching, a focus. How about this? A focus area of 7 checkpoints that our players are going to rate themselves on, and I'm going to rate them on, and then we're going to meet each week and saying, how are you doing in these 7 different areas? And they rate themselves on a simple 1 to 10 basis. And I use the 1 to 10 chart all the time, and I love it because players can basically say, hey, my forehand is at a 5 or a 6. Or wait a minute, my match play skill is at a 7. And wait a minute, my fitness it is at a certain level. Now, in doing this and naming it, and then you name it, you claim it, and you tame it, You don't name it, claim it, blame it. And often you don't want to say, hey, your forehand stinks. It's better to say, hey, you know what? Your forehand is at a level 6 right now, moving to a 7. Here's what you do. And it's more like, hey, I can address that issue as if it were my race car that I'm going to get a better, an oil change and a better tune-up, and it's going to run better. Yeah, once you say your forehand stinks or you're not very fit, if you say you're not very fit, this is like telling somebody, hey, listen, you're this or you're that, you're bad or you're not good. And it doesn't work in coaching as well. It becomes too personal. What you do is, hey, you might work on this to become more fit, or, you know, let's do these things. In other words, always from the minute I started coaching, I realized that if I say you're lazy, for example, it's not as good and not as effective as saying, you know what, you're not. I think you could do much better than this. You can try. This isn't your normal self, is it? Is this your normal self today? Whoa, wait a minute. Is this your normal self? Are you doing everything you want to do? And, oh, watch out, because if you do this, every habit in the end has its way of clamping down on you, and what you do will become who you are. In other words, when does a person who acts lazy become a lazy person? So you understand where I'm going here. So when I try to name it, claim it, tame it with the players, get them to name it, claim it, tame it, never name it, claim it, blame it. So what are these 7 areas? So here's what I do. And I got to give you a little bit more background. First of all, look, every Friday of the fall, if you look in your newspaper, your local newspaper, let's say you live in Florida, and they'll say the Florida Gators are playing the Florida State Seminoles or something. When Florida, the Gators, has the ball, when the Seminoles have the ball, what about special teams? So it matches up offensive postures versus defensive postures versus special teams versus other situation. Now think about it in tennis. We talk about, oh, that guy's forehand is so good. Oh, that serve is so good. Oh, my golly, is he really ripping that backhand? And that doesn't inspire. That is just too shallow. We can do that the rest of our lives, and we're still doing a 14-year-old lesson. Let's talk about it this way, though. Let's break it down, first of all, like the football, basketball guys do on a Friday or Saturday before a ball game. Number one, there's only 3 postures in tennis. That is, I'm fighting for the offense. I'm fighting in the delayed pressure versus delayed pressure. The second is my offensive posture against your defensive posture. The third is your offensive posture against my defensive posture. Did I say that right? My offense against your defense, your offense against my defense, and the delayed pressure. So those 3, and when I chart, I often chart this way. So let's break it down. Understanding this, this is what I put up on the blackboard, and this is what I'm doing with my players. Every week, I'm having them fill out their evaluation of where they're at. Number one, your first exchanges, balls number 1 through 3. In other words, serve, return, and the server's first ball after the serve. In other words, it's more than serve and returns. You serve to set up your second shot. Isn't every shot in tennis supposed to be penultimate, next to the last? When you start trying to finish off every shot, you will quickly lose, because then you start checking out. You have to even construct points with the winners that you hit. So each shot is penultimate. So your first exchanges are serve, return, and the server's penultimate shot is next to the last shot, is but the third shot. And in third shot, hopefully with your service strategy, you're trying to get on the offense and try to win the service games. So I will ask players, where are you at with your first exchanges? So I'm looking up here at my board. and I see my team captain, who's a great guy with great ground strokes. He only gave himself a 4. I said, whoa, okay, so you're not getting into the points. You've got to get into the points to play the points. You're not getting into the points quite effectively enough, are you? And, okay, how can we get this moderately better or somewhat better or make progress? Then we address first exchanges. So on the 7-part system, the players, then we talk about the meat of the point, balls through 4 through 10 plus. It might be balls 4 through 16. And isn't it amazing when we watch the U.S. Open next week? The players battle now. It looks like ping pong, doesn't it? I mean, to get a ball past a player and hit a winner is darn right near impossible, because the movement, it used the ball striking at one time had overcome the movement, but the movement to the ball and the recovery steps are now finally catching up with the ball striking. So we once again have symmetry, and it's pretty darn fun to watch Djokovic and Wawrinka and Andy Murray and these guys. Oh, my golly, I hope Federer gets to play. But to watch them battle, it's almost ping pong, isn't it? The ball striking is absolutely phenomenal now. But the players have finally, after about 15 years, I think about 2,000 people started figuring out. Hey, the decade of the 90s, I don't want to go back into this, but just a little background information. You know, in the 80s, everybody had big rackets, but they had small racket technique. In the 90s, everybody finally started catching on to the ball striking. And so the ball striking was tremendous, and everybody talked about first strike tennis. That was the coined phrase. And little by little, with the Roger Federers and the Nadals and the others and some of the great clay court players, we finally started figuring out the footwork to the ball, recovery steps back from where you hit the ball, and the shot selection. Hear me again, footwork to the ball, recovery steps back, and the shot selection to keep the geometry of the court closed, keep the court closed so that ball striking no longer overcame movement. Because through the 90s, it was quite frustrating to watch bam, 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 point over. And nobody could figure out what in the world was going on. Well, they had to adapt technique. And once the technique was adapted with these high-tech rackets, first strike tennis made ball striking more important than over ball striking overcame movement. Now, it's beautiful to watch the symmetry has finally come back. And symmetry's always been there in the women's game because the ball striking is not quite as much. But my golly, it's finally coming back, and finally we have the art back into it. Okay, so first exchanges. Let's get back to our point. First exchange is ball 1 through 3. Second part of the point is the meat of the point, balls 4 through 10. The third part of the point is having a weapon to finish the point, finishing the point. So listen now. Here's what you need to understand. If I chart a player that I've been with a long time, instead of just the simple charting I gave you of errors, forcing errors, winners, and the opponent's errors times a force, and accepting my player's errors, there's only 6 ways, again, for the point to end. The 3 ways you win is hit a winner, force an error, accept an error. Then 3 ways you lose point. The best way is the opponent's winner. You get forced an error. The worst way to lose the point is your own error. Now, with that, I would always chart that way. But I start, after I'm with a player for a long time, I chart them in terms of first exchanges. Where are they at? Matching up first exchanges against the opponent's defense. Then the meat of the point, I try to chart that. How well are we doing in the meat of the point? And then the weapons to finish the point. And there you will be able to find a new way of evaluating your player, but also to find the formula for winning and often winning and losing. So it's really it's a darn good way to do it. So those are the main three. Again, if you, here's how you play a point. First exchanges, serve return, and first ball after the serve. Wow, if you get good at that and get in control of point on your service games, that often allows you to win the whole lot of points. I hate to say cheap points, but it allows you to win some quick points. The meat of the point, 4 through 10, is the line of scrimmage. You have to do your directionals. You have to be solid off the ground. You have to understand the premise of giving yourself time while taking the opponent's time away. So this is a huge, huge area. I work very, very hard with my team on this area. Matter of fact, you know, we last year, the losses that we took, if we could have served underhanded in half of those losses, I believe that we would have won probably 10 to 12 more matches because we are very, very good in the meat of the point. And I recognize the meat of the point is like the line of scrimmage in football. If you don't control the line of scrimmage in football, it's very hard to win in the end. Same thing in basketball. If you don't control the paint, if you don't control the work that's done in the paint, which means in the lane, under the basket, the blocking out and all the fundamentals, it's hard to win. The meat of the point is critical. You learn how to control the meat, get better in the meat of the point, and little advantages become big differences or little differences. I have a slice backhand, you don't. I can force you a little bit more with my forehand and you can't. Become big, big differences, big advantages late in the match. Now, the weapons to finish the point. A lot of people can set the table, but they can't finish the point. And this is important. If you have a good athlete, you've got to do the other things, but you've got to take advantage of the athleticism to try to finish the point at the net or with a weapon. So I have my players. Let me see what my captain did here yesterday. He gave himself a 4 on first exchanges, meet at a point. He said, Coach, I'm a 7. I said, I disagree. You're an 8. You're pretty darn rough if you got serve underhanded. And then closing out points at Coach, I'm only a 6. I said, yep. Now, what are you going to do to try to bring that up to a 7? So you see where I'm going with this. This is really a very, very good way for the players to make light years jump. And we're not just talking about hitting forehands, hitting backhand. Hey, how's my serve going, man? I've got a lot of cheap points on my serve finally. It's much more than that. Now, two more areas. Your service game offensive posture. In other words, your ability to dictate and try to play offense and force errors or hit winners on the service game. On the return game, I stress your defensive posture, your ability to make the opponent lose. Either their unforced error, you force them into an error. Once again, offensive posture on the service game. You dictate play with your serve. Somehow or another, you have to dictate on the first or the second shot where you get in control of the point on your service game. Now, the mistake, if you're an attacking player, my service game is good, my return game is crummy. No. My service game is good because I'm a good athlete. I have great offensive posture. But in my return game, I need to learn how to make the guy lose. In other words, beat the guy with the service game. Make him lose his return game. And that's what the deal is. The mistake is made when you try to attack on your service game and attack on your return game. And pretty soon, you're attacked out. You've used all your bullets. And your opponent's counterpunching has picked up to the place where they are cutting you up, slicing and dicing you, and you don't have anything left under the hood. Likewise, if you're a defensive player, you play defensive on your service return game and your service game. Well, look, you've got to learn some offense on your service game. So I have my players set this up to where what is your offense to win points by forcing an error and by hitting winners on your service game. On the return game, I try to get the players to force errors and accept errors and to break the opponent down. Now, there's times where you have to attack now and then, and I've elaborated this in the momentum section before. So, but that's number four and number five, and I could go in greater detail, and you can come up with drills yourself. But if you can just remember, look, when you're offensive, you're an offensive football team, you're trying to force the action. Defense is just that. It's defense. You know, and there's times where you have to have an attacking defense, but if you run the blitz every play, look, the blitz is a changeup, or that's a changeup play. But this is the way that you have best results with players if they understand what they're trying to do. So now they're talking about, okay, coach, my first exchanges are coming around. I've been working on my serves and returns, and guess what, coach? I've done this on my serve. I've done this on my return. My first exchanges are coming around. Now, oh, hey, coach, the meat of the point, I've gotten pretty good through ball 12. I'm getting rough, and nobody's beating me off the ground anymore. And, hey, coach, by the way, I'm developing that big forehand to finish the point. Hey, coach, I've been finishing at the net. My volleys have really picked up. So now they're not talking about just forehands and backhands. And they're not just talking about their writing, the cursive writing. They're actually writing the essay. They're writing the story. Service game, offensive posture. Return games, defensive posture is a big, big, big thing if you're a coach out there and you're wondering why your player can't hold serve or break serve. They need to understand that on a service game, they need to beat the guy, other person, and on a return game, they make them lose. So I want to move on here, and the last two I have them marked down is what is your fitness excellence? What is your fitness excellence for playing, and what's your match play excellence? So this is a seven-point charting that I have them do self-evaluation. I call it the player weekly self-charting, self-rating chart. So first exchanges, number one, first exchanges. Number two, meet at the point. Number three, weapons to finish the point. Number four, your service game offensive posture, your ability to win points or force errors. Then number five, the return game defensive posture, your ability to make the opponent lose. Number six, fitness excellence. And number seven, your match play excellence. So why in the world then, once we get a player's game in pretty good shape, what are some of the things we do poorly? I want to bring these out. These are three things I really think as a coach that we do poorly. Number one, our barometer for rating, for finding out where we're at now. If you want to take a journey, I've said this before on a program, you need two things. You need to know where you're going, but more importantly, tennis players and coaches, you need to know where you're at. Most tennis players do not want to know where they're at. They pretend where they're at, but you need to know where you're at. You know, we rate a player's success and failure based on who they beat. Well, was that player injured that day? Did they have a headache? Were they really at their best? And it really leads to skewed results. And again, I've said this story before, but it reminds me earlier this summer, I called home and I asked my wife, I said, how did our daughter do at the swim meet? She said, well, she won her heat. I go, whoa, great job, great job. She won her heat. And my wife said, no, she was 5 seconds slower than her time is supposed to be. I go, whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay, so she was in a bad heat, or she was in a heat that did not stretch her. She said, my wife, yes. She called me Charlie. She goes, yeah, Charlie. She says, our daughter has to be able to push herself without somebody being there to push her. So we're able to address it. So in tennis, we mess up because, oh, I got to win over the number three seed. Well, thing you fail to tell us, they had a hamstring pull or they had a headache or, you know, it could have been anything. They weren't at their best. There's a lot of skewed results. So that's number one reason why we don't improve. Look, the the thing we do at number two, we keep repeating the same third grade math of the training. As I've said, we just work on forehands and backhands and serves. I hope today I gave you a couple things for insights into a better weight for your player to sort of have a barometer for where they're at. Now, the third thing, and this is a critical thing, is that we give up on a player too soon when they're going through the breakdown before the breakthrough period. We look at a player like, hey, the magic is gone. What happened to the magic? But I quick story. I work with this young lady, and she's a very good player, had a lot of success last year. And I was working with her, and she's young, just getting the skill set down, and she was riding pretty high. Well, lately, in the last month or so, her mother came out, and she's very, very worried, says she's not developing, and she got beat by three players that she used to beat handily, and she's down at the dump. She can't find what's wrong with her game. Her racket, it might be the racket. She changed her racket. I said, no, 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 no. He says, oh, she is lacking motive. I said, I looked at the mother, and I said, you know what? It looks like she's getting ready to make a big jump. Her mother looked at me like I was from Mars at first. No, no. I said, always players have breakdowns before breakthroughs. It is a reality of sport. And if you will forgive me, listeners, I'm going to read this short article about breakdowns before breakthroughs, and I'll try to abbreviate some of the things. It's just real short, though, but here's what it says. Breakdowns before breakthroughs is absolutely one of my favorite sayings because it's been proven so many times over my coaching career. I don't know why this is so, but so many multiple times I've seen good athletes and good teams make breakthroughs to higher levels immediately after they were on the brink of disaster and almost wanted to quit their sport. There's just something about the gut-wrenching pain and of a heartbreaking loss or setback. You know, they're the kind of losses where you say it's not really worth it anymore, the pain is too great, I don't want to go on, and you really just feel like selling your rackets and giving the sport up, you know. But my take, though, on this pain that is feared too much is really the critical ingredient and the last little bit that is needed to push you through to a breakdown period that you've trained so long for. It's the last test. And this reminds me of, folks, I'm off the story here, but it reminds me of you can go to video on YouTube and watch this guy who was a professor at Carnegie Mellon, and it was called The Last Speech, I think, The Last Speech. And he talks about the obstacles are there to separate you from those who aren't going to make the journey, but you've got to be willing to make the journey. So he said, perhaps the whole scenario also happens because you've gone through this pain and you just basically, you finally break through because you have the courage, or just maybe you faced the pain so many times that you're just not afraid of it anymore. It's sort of like you've seen the monster enough. Isn't that what happens when we finally get to a level? We've just seen it. You've been to all the circuses. You got all the t-shirts, you know, but you've been to all the contests. You've just done it enough. But pain is part of the ingredient. And that's not the case if the loss is handled in the right way. In order to go forward, the loss must be handled in the right way. Sometimes the pain of a loss can cause us to run and hide our head in a hole and just even be afraid of ever trying that hard again. We might even think that we've given our best, and we might fake it like we're giving our best. We might go right to that point where the pain starts to come, the pressure starts to come, and then we just back off and don't engage. Doing this sets up a scenario that's really hard to break through in the end because you failed the test, basically, of the breakdown before the breakthrough. I call this the Gilbert syndrome, named after a former player. In the early stages, this was a guy that was on my team at one time, and I'm referring to it when he had to make a mile time. And what happened was that he almost got the 5:15 mile. He got 5:16 or something, and then he just backed away from the pain. And after, oh gosh, it took 2 or 3 months where he would go forward again. His heart was broken after the big loss. When he came up short, he withdrew energy the next time, stopped trying and working as hard, and basically went back into the pond where he was more comfortable with his environment around him and the friends around him. This is the way tennis works with a pecking order for sure. This caused him to fall off track so badly that he almost never recovered, only through a lot of coaxing, a lot of time, and really naming it, claiming it, and taming it, we're able to go forward. This is one of the coaches' worst fear, though, that the player will get hurt so bad that they'll give up, that their confidence will be broken, and they never, ever get back to that same level. The giving up scenario causes people to withdraw energy, make excuses, come up with mysterious injuries. Wow, I've seen that one a lot. Having you coaches out there, these mysterious injuries, the phantom injuries, the emotional problems and all these things, they're all the symptom of not wanting to face it. All are just a defense mechanism that comes out when the pressure is great and the players run and hide from the pain. However, if the athlete is truly on route and does the try again, if at first you don't succeed, try again, or I'm going to do the next right thing, and they do not withdraw energy, they're going to break through, and it breaks through to a new level, and I guarantee it. I told the young lady that, and I told her parents, I said, when you dislike losing enough, you will learn to win at this new level. I guarantee it. Now, I truly believe that the mental obstacles and emotional obstacles today athlete truly override many of the physical considerations. And I see the differences of what motivates an athlete today as opposed to years ago. As most athletes were formerly afraid of failing, today's athletes are really more afraid of the high level of success and the responsibilities that come along with it. Hey, guys, I recently told my boss, I said a lot of times athletes, and I really believe this, that people will fail if the excuse is comfortable and convenient rather than to go through the pressure. I tell young kids in camp that it's the Spider-Man syndrome. I always say, with great power, and they say, comes great responsibility. And you can tell other groups that in the scripture it says, to whom much is given, much is expected. And with that comes pressure. Now, this not be confused with any type of mediocre success that comes with a cheaper price. This I'm talking now about, again, the gut-wrenching pain when you really, really, really want something and you can't quite break through. Many will easily give 80% after they're hurt the first time, and then they'll back off. I have told athletes over and over that if you give everything and you fail, it will be like a broken bone that when it heals, it will be twice as strong and you're ready for that challenge the next time. However, if you back off, it still hurts, but it's more like a disease or a sickness, an illness that you carry around. And even when you get better, you're really weaker and you never get to that threshold again for that breakthrough. The dominant factor for success is not based solely on the physical part of the game. In another time, when opportunities were not as abundant, lots of chances to succeed were needed for building confidence. And look, today, let me rephrase this now. In the old days, opportunities were not abundant. People needed opportunities, as I've said, ability, desire, opportunities help. But today, athletes get so many chances to succeed, so many opportunities that they easily discard them. They don't see the diamond for the rhinestone. I told my youngsters the other day in a meeting, my team, I said, guys, again, you know, the world promises you buckets of rhinestones with all the opportunities for cheap things, but God gives you the chance to make one diamond with your life. Whoa, that is a powerful, powerful thought. Now, look, when you care a lot, it's going to hurt a lot when you lose. That's just the way it is. Okay, when you care a lot, it's going to feel great when you win. The whole key to the puzzle is learn to keep caring and keep engaging. The breakthrough is much closer than you know. It's always a that breakthrough is always a really a simple answer and an obvious answer. It's right in front of you, but often we're too terrified to even look. Two of my favorite sayings I use with my athletes today is, never let a win go to your head, but never let a loss go to your heart. If handled properly, wins should go to your heart for confidence, while losses go to your head for learning. And, you know, what a very tough balance this is to achieve. Also, I like the saying that you're in the process of winning or losing every day of your life, and it has very little to do with a win or a loss. And I always end my show each week with that saying. And I hope that it resonates with people out there that go through the up and the down emotions of winning or losing. No matter how it feels, the next time it hurts a lot, know that you are in within inches of succeeding. Now, that's my article. If you like a copy, you can email me, and I will send you one back. And it's a good one to use for your youngsters, called Breakdowns Before Breakthroughs, A Reality of Sports by Chuck Cree. I wrote this probably 20 years ago. So I think that the problems that we have in motivation often are generational. But I thought that would be a good thing to talk about today when we're talking about streamlining our coaching and things. But we really do make those three mistakes, don't we? Don't we make the mistakes of not having an accurate barometer? Don't we make the mistakes of maybe paralysis by analysis, by going forehands, backhand serves, and all the little things? And we're looking at the spices for the soup that's probably not the right analogy. We're looking at the ingredients we use for the soup instead of really how to make the soup. Again, try this with your players. First exchange is meet at the point, weapons to finish, service games, offense, return games, defense, fitness excellence, match play excellence. It works, folks. It really will help your players make jumps, and then they're going to come around to you and they say, hey, coach, hey, can you help me work on that forehand? Can you help me work on that backhand? My offense would be better if I had to. Oh, hey, coach, can you help me learn how to plant my feet on the baseline and not get pushed back? That would sure help my my countering posture. And your players would start thinking about the game, you know, at a higher level. But last thing is why we mess up in our coaching, I think, is that we think winning and losing is about magic. They got the magic. They got the feel now. They've got this winning ingredient. No, it's, look, always remember that player that's going through the hardest time, that breakdown before breakthrough ingredient is absolutely positively the most important thing to learn. And, you know, that quitting thing, I had a few players quit the team, you know, before school started. A recruit didn't make it in, and they just decided it wasn't for them. And then another player who was he was a pretty good player, but the point is they quit. And it's a tough deal. But all I say to the other players, this quitting thing, don't ever start it. It's sort of a disease that you don't want to get into your, you know, background, and it's a hard one to get out of. And there's a difference between quitting and changing directions. Some players, you know, it's okay to change directions if you're going to something, but you should never quit and run from something, especially something that is good for you. And hey, we could talk about the black door forever. That, you know, that black door fear that we talk about fear of the unknown. And I will challenge, I would just say, this is just a statement, it's not a challenge, that most of the time people fail out of fear of success and responsibility of it and the life that they will have to lead in maximizing their skill that God has given them. Everybody's afraid of this. There's no heavier burden than a great opportunity. So, folks, I very much appreciate being with you today. Thanks for listening. Again, it's chuckcreasy.net if you want to go to my websites. Also, shoot me an email, chuck@coachcreasy.com, and let me know what you'd like to have programs about and the type of guests we'd like to have. And again, go back last week and listen to Robert Davis's. Boy, what a wealth of information that man who's traveled the world for 26 years. Fantastic. And so that's
made in America, born in a heartland, raised up a family, a King James and Uncle Sam. He's got the red, white, blue, flying high on a farm. Semper Fi tattooed on his left arm. Spent a little more in the store for a tag in the back of his USA. Made in America. Made in America.
And this is Coach Chuck Creasy reminding you that you're in the process of winning or losing every day of your life, and it has very little to do with a win or a loss, and we play the greatest sport in the greatest country in the world. And let's make them in America, folks. God bless you, and we will see you next week.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.